University of Waterloo, student of Joe's, and is going to talk on this interesting recent work, frame representation of quantum mechanics and the necessity of negativity in quantum problems representation.
Yes, it's a mouthful, but it encapsulates the entire topic. All right, thank you very much. I want to thank Chris Fuchs, who's not here, for inviting me. This is, as Lucien said, recent work. Here's the archive reference. It was posted yesterday. Yeah. Okay, so, right. So here's the outline of the talk. So I'll give a brief introduction, and what you'll see there is so an introduction to phase-based functions, which are meant to represent quantum states. And there's a variety of these, and they've been used to gain insights into quantum information tasks and address notions of non-classicality. And the variety of these representations prompts a couple of questions, one being, what is the underlying mathematical structure of these? And what is the general class of all possible representations? So that'll be answered in the second part. And in the third part, I'll say something about what this frame representation implies about non-classicality. And then I'll conclude with some remarks. Okay, so the discrete Wigner function. The Wigner function, if you recall, is a function on phase space, which is meant to represent the quantum state or wave function of an infinite dimensional quantum system. Now there are a variety of these quasi-probability representations, as they're called. And they're called this because they're otherwise classical probability densities, except for they can take on negative values. And the most important one is the Wigner function. So many authors have tried to find discrete analogs of the Wigner function, and thus called discrete Wigner functions. I'll probably just call them phase space functions, just due to the variety of them. And so did I say that? Okay, so many authors have defined candidate analogs of the Wigner function, defined for a d-dimensional quantum state on finite phase spaces. Okay, so what are some examples? Well, in the 87, Wooters came up with a phase space function that was defined on a d by d lattice, and the lattice was, the axes of the lattice were indexed by integers modulo d for all d, where d is prime. And he also had one for composite dimensions, and the phase space there was just a Cartesian product of the phase spaces for prime dimensions. Next, maybe five or six years later, was Leonhard, and he had a 2D by 2D lattice indexed by the integers modulo 2D, which is valid for D being an even integer. So this one encoded redundancy in the quantum state. Yes, for composite dimensions, it was a Cartesian product of these finite dimensional lattices. Next, we have just d points on the sphere, or d squared points on the sphere. In fact, these could have just been randomly placed on the sphere, and that would be sufficient to define a phase space function on that. Wigner called these constellations. And then the one that's most actively studied, I believe, is this one by Gibbons, Hoffman, and Wooters. Wooters had an earlier paper which outlined the idea. And this is a d by d lattice indexed by the elements of a finite field of dimension d when d is a power of a prime. Is there one more? No. OK. Right, so there was, as you can see, there's many of them all defined on different classes of dimensions of phase space, and using different mathematical terminology. You had finite fields and spheres and lattices, right? So these representations have already been applied to studies in the quantum classical contrast for finite dimensional systems. Paz looked at a Wigner function or phase space function and applied it to quantum teleportation. Again, Paz and Lopez, decoherence in quantum walks. Algorithms. This one used the redundant representation of Leonhardt. Galois, quantum computational speed up, and the positivity in the most recent work by Wouters. And very recently, there was an archive paper by David Gross and Jens Eisert on quantum expanders, where it was claimed that this was the first instance of discrete phase-based techniques actually being used to what did he say? The first real example of phase space being used to derive some results as opposed to just applying it to known areas. I don't know much about the quantum expander graphs, so I'm not going to say more about that. Okay, so a lot of these notions dealt with negativity. And this is because the negativity of the Wigner function is often attributed to the non-classical features displayed by quantum system, since a non-negative Wigner function is equivalent to a classical probability density. Okay. Now, the application of any one of these quasi-probability representations in the context of determining criteria for non-classicality of a given quantum task is limited in significance by the non-uniqueness of that particular representation. Okay, so they used just one definition of the Wigner function, where they could have used others or many representations. And ideally, what we'd like to say is we want to determine whether a task can be expressed as classical process in any quasi-probability representation. Okay, so let me make a definition of what I mean by quasi-probability representation. So let gamma be some set with positive measure, and we define a quasi-probability representation to be a map from the Hermitian operators on some finite dimensional Hilbert space to square integrable real-valued functions over this measurable space. And it has to be linear and invertible. So all the known phase space functions satisfy this criteria. Well, I want these representations to live in a Hilbert space.
It does
mean that it might not be integrable at all. If it's only square integrable. I mean, they're not the same thing.
If the space is unbounded, I mean, if it's like a function space.
Well, it's going to be a compact space.
It has to be a compact space.
If it's linear and invertible, it's the mapping. And the Hermitian operators form a compact space, then gamma will be the compact space.
In which case, L2 and L1 are everything is at least both L2 and L1.
Right.
But I think what Matt is saying is that because you have a map on operators, they're like, this is rho to something, not psi to something.
Right.
And so you'd say that this should be L1. The function itself should be integral, but not at square.
But I guess it could be confusing things like choice, basically.
But just, this is, it's a map. What does perm of H, that means the space of operators on H, or?
The real Hilbert space of Hermitian operators on the, on some arbitrary complex.
Is it bound to Hermitian?
No, the Hilbert space, the Hilbert space is finite dimension, dimension D through it. Right, so, and then there's other representations. Lucian. Lucian has, in his axioms paper, has a representation which satisfies this criteria. So gamma, in that sense, in that case, is finite dimensional. And then you just have a vector instead of function.
The Wigner representation normally is not in a bounded finite dimensional. I mean, what is that usually?
Right, so we're looking for discrete analogs of the Wigner.
I see.
Well, I'm allowing continuous representations of a finite dimensional space in this definition.
So it's just a linear and vertical map from finite dimensional Hilbert space operators and square functions. And you're going to call that a quasi-probability representation.
Real value.
And later you'll justify what it has to do with probability, I guess.
Right, okay. So let me also make a further definition. Suppose some symmetry group is acting on gamma, call it G, which carries a unitary representation on this Hilbert space. Then a quasi-probability representation satisfying this extra covariance property is called a phase-based representation. And so you can always can identify, for all known discrete Wigner functions, you can always identify a group such that it satisfies this criteria.
Right, could you, are there two gammas, or did I just read that? A symmetry is called G, but then it says...
This is, I just wanted to mention this. This is an important reminder. Okay, so frames. So a frame can be thought of as a generalization of an orthonormal basis. And let me just put the definition up here. So a frame for a Hilbert space, in this case, the real Hilbert space of Hermitian operators, is a mapping from that measurable space, gamma, to the Hermitian operators, which satisfies this property. So while you absorb that, I'll write it down. Right, okay, so some notation. Hats will always be operators on the Hilbert space. The inner product here is the Hilbert Schmidt inner product, the trace inner product between operators. Is there anything else? The norm is the two norm induced by the inner product. Okay. So the mapping, which takes an operator to a function defined by the trace inner product, is where this E is a frame, is called the frame representation of the Hilbert space of Hermitian operators. That's the definition. All right, dual frames. So a dual frame is also a frame in the same sense I just defined, which satisfies this property. So it's dual to E. So, I mean, to specify dual frame, you need a frame in the first place. I should mention that. So the dual frame F is such that it satisfies this reconstruction property. So if I can find, given a frame E, if I can find a frame F which satisfies this for all A, then that frame is a dual frame. So when gamma is finite and equal to the dimension of the Hilbert space you're considering, then the dual frame is unique. And it's called, well, it's unique. Otherwise, there are infinitely many choices for a dual frame. So even if the size of gamma is d squared plus 1, I have redundancy and I have infinitely many dual frames, which satisfy this property.
Then it doesn't exist.
Then it can't be affirmed.
So when you say it's unique, are you implying it exists also?
There always exists one dual frame called the canonical dual frame. When the frame is a basis, then the canonical dual frame is the unique dual frame. Or, and in that case, you might just call it a bi-orthogonal basis. But otherwise, if the cardinality of this set is bigger than the dimension of the space, then it's not a basis anymore. It's just, in finite dimensions, it's just a spanning set. And then there are infinitely many dual frames. But one, to show the existence of one is easy. I won't do that.
But an overcomplete basis.
Right, so in finite dimensions, a frame and overcomplete basis. Probably the same thing. Okay, so a mapping of this form is a quasi-probability representation if and only if it is a frame representation for some unique frame. And let me just run through the proof. So the one direction is easy. A frame representation is obviously linear and invertible. So I'll just do the other direction. So suppose some mapping, call it R, is a quasi-probability representation. So it's linear and invertible. Then, as I said, the set is necessarily compact because the Hermitian operators on a finite dimensional space is compact. We use the Riesz representation theorem to show that there is some set or some mapping of gamma to the Hermitian operators, which is given by the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. Not necessarily a frame yet, but there is some unique mapping. Since R is invertible, that mapping must have been surjective on the space of Hermitian operators. So I define this to be the lower frame bound here.
Why does it follow that gamma is compact because the Hermitian operators on H are compact?
So this mapping R, because it's linear and invertible, you can show that it's continuous. A continuous mapping of a finite or compact set is compact.
So, okay.
You have that artistic if you want to use it at this point.
So maybe I can ask a specific question. Let's suppose H is one-dimensional. It's very boring, right. Trivial, essentially. The Hermitian operators on H are just scalars, real numbers.
Right.
And I'm going to map that to L2 functions on the real line. Each real number is going to get mapped to that real number times a normalized Gaussian on the real line. So the real line is not compact, and I've mapped, that's a linear invertible mapping.
Okay. So repeat the mapping, it's mapped to Gaussians?
Right, so I just, every element of permission in H is just a real number, right? Because H is one dimensional. So the operators on one dimension are scalars. And so for every real number, I'm going to map it to that real number times a normalized Gaussian on the real numbers. So it's just a map between real numbers and Gaussians. So I've done, obviously I could have done this onto a compact space,
right.
But I've also done it onto a non-compact space, right?
I wanted to know, you're positive that this is an invertible map? I mean, so you're
just mapping as Gaussian as well.
The statement is that permission
H is compact. That's a strange statement.
Yeah, because permission H.
Permission operators include all multiples, real multiples of the identity. That's what you're basically using.
Which is not compact.
Which is not a compact.
So, that's normalized.
So do you mean,
so I'm not actually
is there some trace right. condition or something? When you say Hermitian H is compact.
So you'd have to do it on a circle or something.
Is it unitary is compact?
Well, I mean, you've got your, yeah.
Well, it's certainly a finite dimensional space, no?
No, it's has a compact, like, just because it's a one-dimensional orbit space, it's just the real one. You're saying, in that case, you're saying the real one is compact, which is
You could fix that by saying normalized operators, right?
Yeah, sure. Normalized somehow.
Like trace normalized.
Like trace normalized.
But you can still, even so, if you look at just the normalized Hermitian operators, like the trace class ones, right? Trace rho equals 1, which are density matrices. You can still map those onto L2 on a non-compact space. But, I mean, maybe it's not important, so.
Right, okay, so I would like to hear more about this, but so at least for the known phase-space functions, they all exist on a compact space, and I'm not sure if it would be fair to say that we would only be interested in representations of finite-dimensional quantum states on compact spaces. But given that, then, so if I assume that gamma is a compact space in the first place, then there's no problem, right?
Especially important.
Right, okay, so for the remainder of what I say, let's assume that gamma is compact. Right, so define this lower plane bound because E was derivatives, right? Okay, so this is lower plane bound, this minimum is guaranteed to exist. Do I say that? Okay, so it's guaranteed to exist because E was surjective and it's going to be greater than 0. The upper plane bound used to catch the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. Gamma is now assumed to be compact, so this is a bounded integral. And by definition, E is a frame. Okay, so with the exception of Lucien's work, and Wouter's original work, most of these quasi-probability representations are representations of states only. So you're at, the question of classicality is always asked of only states and their phase space representations. So now I'm going to show you two approaches on how to lift any representation of states to a full theory of quantum mechanics and other stuff. Okay, so this space is a Hilbert space. If I define the following, okay, so let me say So there exists axioms of quantum mechanics, take Lucian's operational axioms, which only rely on the inner product and algebraic structure on the Hermitian operators. So I define the inner product on L2 of this space to be this. And I define an algebraic multiplication in this way. And now I don't use the usual inner product on L2. I use this inner product and this multiplication. And then the frame representation is now an isomorphism between these two Hilbert spaces. And so the first way to do it is you represent states as the frame represented functions. You represent measurements in this with the same frame. And then using the isomorphism, then it's easy to see that the probability of some outcome when measuring this measurement in some state row is given by the inner product, which I showed. Let me write that down. So the first method is drop those. So there's the first method. Okay, the second approach. States I represent in the same way as I did before. I choose some frame. I represent the states as the frame represented functions for some frame. And measurements I represent as some other set of functions which were mapped with the dual frame. When I do this, the set same probability is now the pointwise inner product on L2. Right, and that.
The measurement is just a field here. So this discrete field here. So positive operators talking about this.
Okay. And then is there some update rule for state?
Sure. I could derive an update rule. I could derive a transformation rule, but I would do that just using the quantum formalism and the isomorphism. Right. So this is quantum mechanics in some concrete Hilbert space as opposed to abstract Hilbert space.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, just the usual point. Okay. So let me define what I mean by classicality. So let gamma represent some properties of a system, and let probability distributions represent your epistemic knowledge.
Sorry to interrupt you. So in the previous section, I think you don't have to flip back or anything, but I want to make sure that I understood what you were doing there. Right. Was your goal to basically demonstrate that we've got a linear representation of states and of effects, and so because it's a linear representation, we can just do all of quantum mechanics in this representation?
Right, yeah.
Okay, so that I wasn't sure if there was something else you were getting at.
Yeah, so I did was define a real concrete Hilbert space, and the isomorphism from the abstract to to this Hilbert space. Ideal measurements, so I'm talking about notions of classical probability here, are represented as Boolean functions over this space. And what this physically implies is that measurements will reveal with certainty the properties of the system. So this is what you would see in an introductory probability course.
Right.
So measurements which don't reveal or have some error or don't reveal with certainty the properties of the system are represented as, I think in fuzzy set theory, they're called membership functions. But they're just functions which map gamma to the interval rather than to the 0, 1. OK, so the definition. So some operational model is called classical if the following holds. There is some set of allowed properties, gamma, which I guess I'll assume to be compact. A state of knowledge is represented as a probability distribution. The measurements, again, are represented as these functions which take values in the interval 0, 1 and satisfy this property so that you're guaranteed that there is some outcome. And the probabilities are calculated in the classical sense via this pointwise interproduct. So a system with probability distribution rho, and you're doing this measurement, then the probability of obtaining outcome k is given by this. So that's a classical model. Yeah.
Those definitions, every probabilistic model is classical, or has a classical representation.
Including quantum?
Yeah, model. Okay, so I'm a bit confused here about whether you're talking about how the model is presented to you, whether that's formalism, or whether it's possible to construct.
Whether it's possible to construct a model which satisfies these properties?
In that case, I think. Yes. I mean, so just take the quantum theory, just take gamma to be the set of all quantum states. For instance,
you have to have negative indicator functions then to model all these quantum states.
No, I mean, it's the set of density operators, right? Mm-hmm. And then the indicator function. Just as the map the states to probability, it gets to that outcome. What do you call it, the membership function?
Well, so I would disagree because I'm going to prove a theorem that says that quantum mechanics can't, but maybe after I do that, you.
But there's, I mean.
So you allow the set gamma to be the. Based on Hermitian operators.
Are we also having the property that there must be this linear mapping from the operators on the H to gamma? That also requires.
Yes.
If that's a requirement, then I agree.
Well, okay. You'll hear this shortly. Okay. So the first approach. Where it was just important, the probability calculation was important. So suppose the frame is such that each E alpha is a positive operator. Well then, applying that first approach, what we find is that the quantum states and measurements are classical by the definition I just said. So the states, what you represent is states of knowledge and your measurements, those will satisfy the requirements of a classical model. But the calculation of probabilities is not classical. It's this what we've called the form. I had it on there after all. Okay, so it's the this calculation of probabilities, and not the classical calculus of probabilities. So it's not classical. How about the second approach? Looks more promising.
Sorry, F alpha beta there is a sort of a metric, right? You're squashing two things, and you've got the
right.
F in the middle. So when you say deformed, does it have to be negative? Does it have to have non-positive eigenvalues?
Yes. It'll be. But so the what I'll say here will apply to that. Maybe I'll mention that.
Okay. If you're going to talk about it more later.
Well, I didn't plan to, but I will now. Okay, so
in the second approach, the probabilities are calculated with the same calculus as in the classical case. Right? And the states, recall, were mapped with a frame, and the measurements with the dual frame. In this case, this model is also not classical because the states and measurements cannot satisfy the criteria that was set out for a classical model. And indeed, they must contain negativity. And I'll prove that now. So so in regards to what Robin said, so if I took this integral and I just did the integration over beta, right, what I would get is P alpha the dual frame. Right? So the theorem applies, and what you said is true, it'll be negative.
When you say it's deformed, does that just mean there exists some F alpha beta that's not delta alpha beta? Or is it a stricter condition, like for instance, that F has to be non-positive? Or what's the criterion for it deformed?
So the criteria would be if you require that all states and measurements are positive and take values in the interval 0, 1, then F cannot be, well, it would have to contain negative values. Is that right?
Maybe I'll ask later on.
I think deformed just means that F is not a delta function. Like, I mean,
that's what
the way the word deformed
right.
is being used.
But something stronger.
But one can say more than that. But,
yeah.
But when you call it a deformed
probability measure,
well,
you're saying that formula is like that with
there's non-trivial F.
So just understand, in the first approach, you're saying that if I integrate over beta, the P alpha I would get can't satisfy what I want probabilities to satisfy.
Right, that'll be negative.
Right, they'll be negative. And so the other way, if I demand those things are positive, then the states get screwed up.
Right. So what this says is that whether...
Okay, so here's the theorem. So there does not exist a dual frame of positive operators for a frame of positive operators. So I can map, I can get all states to be positive, but then my measurements will have to be negative. My indicator functions will have to contain negative values,
or vice versa. Or in the case of the Wigner function, you have some trade-off. OK, so consider this mapping. Tilde is a super operator. If this mapping were the identity, I didn't write down the definition of dual frame, but if you recall, if this mapping were the identity, then by definition of the dual frame, this F would be dual to E, because this would just give you the reconstruction formula that defines the dual frame. Okay, so just choose some standard basis. This is now linear operators on H. So choose some standard basis. And then the Choi-Jankowski representation of that superoperator is defined to be this. Continuing, then you can show
that it's a convex combination of these operators. And If those operators are both positive frames, then this would be a separable operator on this tensor product space. But it is known that the Choi-Jamakowski representation of the identity, actually it's quite trivial, that there's not a separable operator on H, thus phi could not have been the identity. Hence, F cannot be dual to B. So this is similar, I mean, it's probably equivalent to the work on entanglement breaking channels by Hordecki and Ruskai and a couple others, I think. So from that paper, you could derive this result, but here's a more direct proof of it. Right. Did I leave anything out? Okay, so Rob introduced this generalized notion of contextuality, which he said was valid for just general operational models. And then more recently, I believe last week or so, he posted a paper on the archive, which he showed that a non-negative quasi-probability representation, so he defined it a little bit differently. He required this classical calculus of probabilities and his notion of a non-contextual ontological model that these are equivalent. So what this theorem of dual frames in the positivity shows is that this provides a proof of Rob's generalized notion of non-contextuality or contextuality of quantum mechanics. Right, so back to what Matt said. Right, so Montina, what he showed was, at least for pure states, that quantum mechanics can be represented as a classical model in the sense that I gave, only if the representation is nonlinear. Right, so I can have states and measurements be functions in the interval 0, 1. The probabilities can be consistent with the classical calculus, but at the expense of linearity. And this is de Broglie-Bohm theory. This is a nonlinear representation of states. What can be said about nonlinearity? Well, it implies non-convexity. So if I wanted to model my quantum experiment as a classical model, and I represented, say, two density matrices by these functions in my frame representation, and then off to the side, I flipped a coin, and I represent, and then I represent the state in quantum mechanics in the abstract is represented as this convex combination, but the function that I represented in my frame representation is not a convex combination of the two that I represented individually. So when I flip a coin off to the side to decide which density matrix or quantum system to prepare, then they're supposed to represent probability distributions now, but I don't represent the overall state as a convex combination. So this sort of defies any notion of classical probability that you can come up with. Okay, so we provided a formalism using mathematical theory of frames, which unifies the known quasi-probability representations of quantum mechanics. We've proven the frame representation is equivalent to a linear invertible representation of quantum mechanics. We've also proven that such representations require either negativity or the deformation of the classical calculus probabilities. And then the conjecture is that these things would hold also for infinite dimensional spaces, such as the Wigner function, Cosimi, P and Q, and the classical representations there. Last slide. Okay, so what do we want to do? So the lofty goal is to identify the complete set of classical quantum information tools. So given some quantum information processing task, determine whether a classical representation exists in the sense that I described. Or prove that no such representation exists. So extend this representation to composite systems and study entanglement. Derive some generalized notion of Moyle type corrections to dynamics. Another lofty goal, identify conditions for quantum computational speed up. And all right, is that all I put? Okay, that's all I put. All right, thank you very much. Hema. So it will
correct the probabilities.
Well, I want to represent my model for my experiment as a classical probabilistic model, right? So the nonlinearity implies non-convexity, right? Which is something that I would want in a classical probability model. But Matt might not want it.
I'm just going to play that with that and tell you what the Bayesians might say about that, which is their representation is only supposed to hold, it's really a change of the larger Hilbert space down philosophy. It's supposed to take the whole universe into account.
Right.
It's only really supposed to apply to pure states. And so then, in that situation, the considerations of convexity in the space of density of the razors don't really come into play so much.
Right.
It's a different framework.
Right.
On this Bohmian thing, when you said it was an example of this nonlinear, what exactly was your space gamma and so on? If you wanted to put Bohm theory in this framework.
So what is gamma in Bohm theory?
Does it include the,
wouldn't be compact.
Is it the space of all wave functions plus
so pure states plus points in configuration space? Cartesian product.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah, so there's a lot of nonlinear theories where you just take gamma to be space wave function and let your map be a delta function.
The other thing, when you said you were talking about a task, computational, there's a sort of assumption in the background that task means something that can be done by a succession of measurements and updates or something like that. I mean, is that right? I mean, you could imagine more general ways of going about solving problems than just a sequence of measurements, some preparation of a state in this sequence.
Specify some preparation procedure and some measurement procedure, and on that view, your task.
I think about maybe as a restriction on the set of possible preparations and measurements, rather than saying quantum mechanics, which has all possible preparations and measurements, you restrict to some, to achieve some particular task, you actually need some subset of those.
But I have the impression it was something like compute a particular function or something, right? Is that the idea of it?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a sort of thesis behind it that you can realize the arbitrary. You can carry out any task by such a procedure. Like,
I think the preparation follows by the sequence of measurements.
Do you have any counterexamples to that? Certainly within the model of quantum computation, right? That's what everything is.
But well, in some sense, maybe. I mean, what about the Hamiltonian?
Well, so that the Hamiltonian, all it does is it rotates your initial state, right, relative to your measurement. So what you'd say is quantum computation is just you prepare an initial state, and then you do an extremely difficult to do measurement.
Well, okay,
but Hamiltonian is by enabling that, right? I mean, it's just a preparation followed by a weird measurement.
Which you might not be able to do at all.
But the way that you do it
I mean
just
I don't know, maybe this is getting off.
Yeah, that's
a completely different question, not about that. Can you flip back to the slide on contextuality? So your proof of negativity was based on the Jamiełkowski isomorphism. You basically said, well, this can't be positive because the Jamiełkowski isomorphism of the identity is not separable. In fact, it's a maximally entangled state. So that seems to imply that if I have any inner product, so you wanted the identity inner product, but I can imagine, right, between, so probabilities, for measurement given state
right.
are just you swash together in Hilbert space the initial state and the final effect. But I could have another model where I put things through a channel first. There's some noise between my preparation and my measurement. Okay. And then the thing, instead of the identity in there as my inner product, I would have some other sort of contractive CP map that would represent noise. And then it seems like you could apply exactly the same thing. You could look at the Jamiełkowski isomorphism of that and say, this has a non-negative classical model, if and only if the Jamiełkowski right. representation of that is a separable state.
Right.
And then that would go to the contextuality. And I guess what I'm wondering is, does that then imply that if the map between the noise that happens between initial states and final states is entanglement breaking, then
right. So if it's entanglement breaking, right, then
because
these two right, so these two operators have to be positive for this channel the entanglement breaking. Here, right, and the identity is not. Cause it, well, you need a rank d squared, I believe. I forget. You need a certain rank of operator for the entanglement.
Right. Yeah, I'm just wondering if we can draw a connection and say you have you can make a non-contextual theory if and only if the noise between preparation and measurement is entanglement breaking. It seems like this approach would imply.
One direction of that, I think, is clear. The other one, I think, is not, because I think, there's like the difference between entanglement and non-locality, they're not the same thing.
I mean, I don't think it holds, and in fact, I talked about this with Rob last week, and he said that he thought there was a gap. That if it's entanglement breaking, then it's non-contextual, but not the other way around. But this line of argument seems to imply that there should be a one-to-one.
No. Because it could be not entanglement breaking. Yeah, it could be not entanglement breaking, but just so happens to give you a certain state in that thing, but.
The Jamiełkowski state is separable if and only if it's entanglement breaking.
Do you see it? I mean, the state can be a state.
Maybe we should take this offline.
Can you say something about? I mean, I'm not very familiar with this whole
formal framework, and I tended to get a little bit lost. But can you say something about the relation of this to the traditional
non, you know, anti-hidden variables. This is a kind of, in the end, what you got is a kind of, maybe I shouldn't call it a non-hidden variable, but a non, you got a model, you got a theorem that said you can't give a classical representation
right.
of quantum mechanics. So, what is this a generalization of the, I don't know, take any one quotient spectrum or something.
So this is.
Is this a generalization of that, or is it?
I mean, in some sense, it's equivalent to the generalization that Rob Speckens put forth of contextuality. So, I haven't thought about this much, but in terms of what this, what I've done says about the traditional notions of contextuality, I don't really, I don't know if I could draw any immediate conclusions from what I've presented to you here, but it's equivalent, what I've proven is equivalent to what Rob proved about his generalized notion of contextuality.
So it might be the case that you could derive some of the others from this or vice versa.
I don't know. Can you derive?
Rob's thing is generalization in the sense that if you apply it just to projective measurements and just locate, you need this fact about states, but if you apply the same definitions just to projective measurements and you also demand that the model gives deterministic outcomes from objective measurements, and this can apply the traditional contextuality.
Some extra non-trivial assumptions for to imply something along the lines of traditional contextuality.
Is there some sort of question specter model? I mean, example, you know, some very concrete thing where you can show how.
Like pick a dimension in Hilbert space and show it?
Well, for one thing, I mean, you have here all, you have, you want to represent all operators and so on. I mean, in that case, you just.
The Gleason theorem. So you know this is.
Gleason theorem is a, yeah, so that was very.
But there's a proof of potentiality that's based on Gleason's theorem, which is shown up. And that's roughly the same thing that this will be.
Right. So then from Gleason's theorem, you can get you don't add anything mathematically exactly, but physically you add because you get a, in quotient spectra, you have a situation with just a finite number of measurements in that correlation
exactly.
instead of a whole infinite Hilbert space.
So if you look in Rob's paper, then there's versions of which you might think of as something like this, but with a finite number.
I mean, I think if you wanted to make an equivalent of quotient spectra in this, what you might do is pick a finite set of states. And show that, right, so this is a quasi-probability representation for all states. You could just say, well, for these 17 states, there is no non-negative quasi-probability representation for just for those states. You don't like having to deal with.
Actually, in that theorem, you don't have to pick a state at all. What you do have to pick is a set of operators, set of measurements.
The outcome determinism assumption is following you a lot there. Because if you drop that, then you have to impose some condition about how the states are represented, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to derive.
Given all, if take the whole class of density operators, this theorem, all it says is that, I mean, there must exist just at least one. One operator in the dual frame, which is negative. So I don't know what can be said about something like how many vectors, like in the quotient spectra theorem, you use 117 and Perez uses 33. I don't think there's anything like this here. But
you think that's not something
like that? No, I mean.
I don't know, but it doesn't seem like it's something like that. But, and that's why
in terms of quantum information tasks, it's not clear how you would prove that there is no non-negative representation, because you have to vary over all possible dual frames and all possible, all of the redundancy that you could have.
You mean, you know, it always
suffices to always just have one negative operator in the whole?
No, the theorem says that.
The theorem says there might be at least one.
At least,
but in fact,
but
it might be that
the representation is linear, so there's kind of
yeah.
Well,
right.
Are there more questions? Okay, so that's time for Chris again.